Welcome again to the EverydayDrinkers.com podcast. This week, we're going to branch off and do another special episode. This time, we're going to be talking with Kevin Carl, a public relations manager for an ice wine company known as Inniskillen. They are representative mainly in Canada. They're a Canadian company, but they've been producing ice wines for many years. And although we have done an ice wine specific podcast, I thought it would be nice not just really to do tasting notes this time, but go into a little about the industry, what makes an ice wine, what are the regions of ice wine, how do they become ice wines, what's the temperatures, why is it so expensive to buy a good ice wine, and some of the dynamic flavors that you can look for in an ice wine. And so there's a lot of information packed into this episode. Hopefully you enjoy it and you can go out and buy yourself some ice wine and really appreciate what you have in front of you. So let's go on with the interview. So tell me a little bit about what you do, where you come from, and how you got into the love of ice wine.
I was living in St. Helena, California, in the heart of Napa Valley in the 90s, working in a public relations agency that focused on food, wine, and hospitality, a lot of California wine. And Inniskillen, in 1999, was launching their ice wine in the United States. It was the first ice wine to come into the United States from Canada. And the agency was awarded the contract. A bottle of wine of this ice wine was plunked down on my desk. You know, here, taste this.
Right.
And Derek, I wish someone had a camera and could take a picture of the look on my face when I tasted that. I had never tasted anything like ice wine up till that point. And as you know, I mean, we can talk about ice wines till the cows come home, but no wine you've ever tasted can prepare you for the flavors that you find in ice wine. So I was like, holy schmoly, what is this? So I was, you know, told it was ice wine and it came from Canada. And I was like, what? You've got to be kidding me.
You guys got grapes up there?
as a matter of fact, I mean, I was dimly aware that they made wine in Canada, but I had no idea that they were making wine this good, nor at the time was I aware that their wine industry was as big as it is. It just wasn't on our radar at the time. And so personally, this was something that was so brand new, that, you know, just outside of my realm of awareness and comprehension. So I became very enthusiastic about this wine. I have a sweet tooth, and I've always liked dessert wines. And this is, you know, dessert wine to the power of 10. From a professional point of view, as a public relations person, you know, I was talking about California wines. Well, in 1990, you know, there's not a whole lot new about California wines. I mean, there are new winemakers, there are new wineries, but everybody knew that California made wine. No one had heard of ice wine, and nobody except, you know, the hardcore wine geeks knew that Canada was producing ice wine and where ice wine had come from. So this was a brand new story. You know, that's a PR guy's dream, is to, you know, to bring the absolutely brand new to writers who, you know, generally are tired of hearing the same old thing. So the response was very, very positive. People were very interested. It's, you know, a really dramatic and extraordinary story. I mean, who knew? And so professionally, it was very, very gratifying to me. And so, you know, personally, I'm happy. Professionally, I'm happy. It's like, hey, I'm in heaven.
So your primary job has always been in sort of the public relations to get the word out about brands.
Yes, that was my job in public relations. I will say that at the age of 40 is when I got into public relations. I was in another industry prior to that. And on the eve of my 40th birthday, I decided I don't want to be doing this for the rest of my life. I was living in Fort Worth, Texas. I was an event planner and manager. And I decided I want to change my life, and I sold my house. I moved to California, and I did indeed changed my life.
And then since because it seems to be that I know a lot of different PR people that do different products, and there are people that are passionate about the industry, and there are people that are like, you know, are excited. Believe it or not, I didn't know this going into it, but that PR people, if you are excited about their product, they're so excited for you that you liked it. Like it's almost becomes their own product, even though you're not in the trenches making the, you know, squeezing grapes, or in this case, frozen grapes. You still have that same passion that it seems that the makers themselves have.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. I don't want to say what makes a good public relations person and what doesn't. Personally, I can't sell something that I don't believe in. That's just how I am. Now, there are hundreds of public relations agencies, and they're in the business to make money. And I would suspect that some of these people aren't really passionate about a product, but you know, there is a certain drill in public relations, and there's, you know, a certain set of rules that you can follow and have a successful public relations effort. I think when you find a public relations person who is really, into your product, that really likes it. I hate the word passion. It's been so overused, but it's true. I mean, that is as passionate as you are about your product. You've got a real evangelist because they are truly interested. And I think as they go out and work with the media and work in the market, that passion is apparent, where the people that they're speaking with can see, you know, this isn't being read from a script. This isn't, you know, doing it by rote. This guy truly is crazy, whether that's good or bad, about the product. And yeah, in regard to these ice wines, I really, it's like everything about them is so interesting to me. And after, it'll be 10 years now since I launched Inniskillen, and I still represent this another brand. I still feel the same level of interest. I haven't gotten bored with it.
Right. And now, is that because every year the wine is new? Like, it's not... Like, for instance, I take Budweiser as an example. It's always the same. Budweiser sells so much because everybody expects it to be a specific taste, a specific property. That's what they make their money on. They live and die on. That's why they got bought for billions. But when it comes to wine, in general, each year you could get something completely different. So it's always a new experience.
Well, there are subtle differences, unlike table wine grapes. For example, let's say Chardonnay, where these are harvested at the traditional harvest time, whether that is, you know, late August, September, October, you know, wherever
right.
Wherever they're being grown. And so if you've had a dry summer, if it's been a wet summer, a hot, cold, there are some really vast differences that can be seen from vintage to vintage. With ice wines, the differences are a lot more subtle. The changes from year to year are more in yields.
Right,
is the number one, because sometimes they are fortunate and they can harvest these ice wines at the beginning of the season, which means they get more of these frozen grapes. And I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, it wasn't until March when they could bring in the majority of the crop. It was a very warm winter. And so that was a very, very short ice wine harvest. So in answer to your question, it's not because the wine is different from year to year. It's because people have been slow to discover ice wines for a number of reasons, which I imagine we'll get into.
Right, right.
And so you're an excellent example of this when you said to me when we began corresponding a month or so ago, a lot of people don't know about these ice wines. And it's true. So this is still a new thing to a lot of people. Sometimes I compare myself to a pusher, because 9 out of 10 people that try ice wines love them.
Right, right.
Because they're just so different and unexpected. And so I really like being the the first person to introduce them to these wines, which is why I really like the opportunity to attend trade shows and consumer wine tastings, because I am there handing over the glass of that wine. And my first, you know, my question to people is, have you ever tasted ice wine before? And if they say no, I'm standing there with my camera to take a picture, because more often than not, the jaw drops.
When I went to the Boston Wine Expo, my mission was to hunt down all of the ice wines. Like, and there were certain ones that weren't that really that great. Other ones that were like, wow, these are really good. But I went in there knowing exactly what I was getting into. So I didn't have that. My surprise was more like the surprise of this is good or this is mediocre, where I've seen people that their first, you know, reaction is, wow, this is like candy. You know, it's not like a red or like a dry wine, or it's not like port either. It's something completely different.
There's nothing to compare it to in the wine world. You can have tasted all of those wines and still, you know, the flavors, that fruit bomb followed by that refreshing acidity, there's just nothing like it.
So
people have, you know, they think, okay, yeah, so it's another wine, and they, you know, have some predisposition about, you know, what a wine is going to taste like, and it doesn't taste like anything that they thought it would.
You're not, you don't find that your mission is done yet. You might get a little bored once you're pushing this and everybody's like, yeah, I've had that, or, oh, it's another version of this. You're still on the, like, this is really the first version. This is the first thing you're going to experience, and you want it to be your brands and go, look, check it out. This is what you've been missing.
That's a fair statement.
You're saying, you know, basically this is kind of new, well, maybe not new, but new to us or new to a wide variety of people. Probably people listening to this are like, I don't know anything about ice wine, and where do I buy this ice wine? When did the, do you know, like, around when this became a viable bottling product?
If I may, I'd like to tell the story linearly.
Okay.
And yes, it is a very fair statement to say that ice wine is a very new wine. To go back to the very beginning, the first vintage of ice wine that's recorded and it's generally accepted as being the first ice wine was made in 1794 in the German wine region of Franconia, when monks were surprised by an early frost. The grapes were still hanging on the vine. And to put this into context, why grapes were still hanging on the vine that late in the season that they froze. Between 1500 and 1850 in Europe, across the globe, actually, is what is known as a Little Ice Age. There was this period of 250 years of global cooling. And so they had left these grapes on the vine waiting for them to ripen. They still weren't ripe in November, and then they froze, and they're like, oh my God, you know, what do we do? And so they tried to salvage this harvest, and they ended up making what we now call the first ice wine, although it was certainly not called ice wine,
right,
at the time. Most German wine writers and people that have researched ice wine generally agree that between then and the 1960s, there were probably maybe 10 vintages of ice wine that were made. And this was simply done as a matter of necessity. Certainly, no one set out to do this because of the, you know, just the entire effort of making ice wine. Plus, that's not what they were going for at the time. This was all just in response to climactic conditions, and you don't waste grapes. You know, you didn't waste anything back in those days.
Right.
Things began to change in 1960 in Germany, and that is when the ice wine industry was born. Essentially, there was a man, his name is Hans Ambrosi, who was I guess for lack of a better term, you could call him Germany's wine czar. Germany has always been, the government has been very involved in their wine industry. He ran across some people that were experimenting with making ice wine in the early 60s. He really liked the idea, and he thought it was great stuff. And so he encouraged this, and he fostered this. And that, you know, might mean some government dollars and some subsidies, you know, however he helped. He helped them do it. So through the 60s, the Germans are making more and more ice wine, and they're refining the techniques, and they're just, you know, they're finding their way with it. Interestingly, even though this is occurring in the 60s, Germany revised their wine laws. There was a big revision and classifications and just, you know, the law. There was a big revision in 1971, and ice wine didn't get its own classification then, which suggests that it was still a novelty and something that they just, you know, weren't, it wasn't on the radar as far as being a commercial product. However, in 1983 is when it got a classification, which suggests there were enough people producing this where they said, okay, we need to standardize this, and here are the rules, and making this stuff.
Right, you got to do it quick, because you don't want, if it goes too quick, like if people start making this thing, you know, making case of this, it's going to get out of control without the proper laws, and then you got like,
well,
Western.
Sure. I mean, it's okay. If we're going to call this ice wine, then this is, you know, what we, these, this is how you're going to produce it.
Right. Otherwise, yeah, you get confusion, like customer confusion. They don't know what's going on. You could label, sure, it any way you want. And,
sure,
and that gets kind of iffy, especially in the wine, because in general, wine is controlled because they want specific regulations in place to say, this is what wine is. That's not, well, wine. That's brandy. That's something, you know, you need some structure. We like structure in our society.
Well, and also, I mean, let's face it, wine is a commodity. You know, there is a big difference in the price that can be commanded for something that is labeled a late harvest wine and something that is labeled an ice wine. At the same time in 1960s, the Austrians also started making ice wines. So that's what's going on over in Germany, you know, from the beginning up until the 1980s. Now let's hop across the pond to Canada, because particularly what I'm most familiar with are the Canadian ice wines. In British Columbia, there was a winemaker. His name is Walter Hanley or Hanley. I've never been quite sure how to pronounce his name. I've only read it. I've never heard his name. He came to Canada in 1970 from Germany and settled in the Okanagan Valley, which is British Columbia's wine region. He made some ice wine in 1973. This is recorded, and he was very proud of doing this. He loved ice wine. He made between 30 and 40 liters in 1973. He was the first person to produce it commercially and offer it for sale. And it was a 1978 vintage, and he had a whopping 230 bottles of this stuff, half bottles to, right, sell. Now, while there may have been some hobbyists, I mean, winemakers are like mad scientists. So I would imagine that, you know, back even in the 30s in Canada, there were people that were, you know, experimenting with making this. None of this is recorded. And so pretty much all of, you know, everybody points to Walter Hanley as, you know, looking at this first.
Well, if you're first to market, then you deserve to get, you know, anybody can, sure, accidentally make something, but it's the person who's going to put their neck out there and say, let's bring this to the people. They're the, sure, ones who get recognition.
Sure. So in the 70s, you know, everybody, you know, in British Columbia and Ontario, all the winemakers started experimenting with, you know, ice wine and making ice wines. In 1983, in the Niagara Peninsula, Peninsula, just in Ontario, just north of Niagara Falls, there was a group of German and Austrian winemakers, Karl Kaiser of Enniskillen, Reif of Reif Estate. They were neighbors, and they were sitting around and talking, and they said, you know, we should, you know, let's try making this. Let's do it. And so in 1983, they set aside some vineyard to let the grapes freeze on the vine so they could make ice wine. They forgot one key, very important part in making ice wine, and that is to net the vines. And while Karl Kaiser knew that that in Germany the vines were netted, he didn't know where to get nets. You know, this was not something that was needed in Canada. And so he thought, let's see what we get without the nets. Well, what he got was a flock of starlings that descended on the vineyard in, you know, the late fall and stripped it bare. 15 minutes, not a grape left, experiment over, done.
Well, the experiment failed, but it was an experiment. You learned from your experience.
Right, right. And he certainly learned from his mistakes. And so in 1984 is when he and some others got an ice wine. There's a lot of other detail in the industry that was going on, but I'm truncating this story.
Right.
So 1984, they get, you know, an ice wine and made it out of a Vidal grape, which was a hybrid that had been planted all over Canada, but had fallen out of favor because vinifera varieties were, you know, what people wanted.
Right.
And so a lot of people were ripping out these Vidal vines, but there were still a lot of Vidal left over. And as it turns out, and I'm sure we'll get into this later, Vidal is like the perfect grape to make ice wines. And so this was like an aha moment, you know, hey, we might be onto something. There were two pivotal points as far as ice wine exploding on the scene. One would be in 1989 when Robert Parker tasted a 1987 Vidal and said, this is the best, one of the best wines I tasted all year. And then in 1991, a Vidal ice wine, the 1989 Vidal ice wine that Enniskillen had produced, won the grand prize, the Grand Prix d'Honneur at VinExpo 1991. And this was to Canada what the 1976 tasting, you know, the judgment in Paris was to California.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my God. And so all of a sudden, Canada's got wine cred, much to the surprise of, you know, the entire wine world. That's when efforts got ramped up and Canada figured out that this would be something that they could produce, very, very well and become the world's largest supplier, which indeed they have.
The first, I mean, big deal there is that even, you know, for the Germans that are in Germany, you're not always going to get a favorable season. So I've noticed that the cost can be a lot more and for the German ones. And honestly, I don't know if they're better, they're different, but Canada's got that. Like, that's their deal. It's cold there. I'm not too far from Canada, right? So, you know, it's going to get cold in the wintertime. You're going to have not necessarily excessively long winters, but they're going to be chilly for a little while. And if you're in the right position at the right time and you can, that's your deal, you might not have the sunshine that you can get out of a Napa Valley, but you got your thing that you can hang on to and say, look, nobody could do this better than us. So, you know, this is our deal. This is what we're gonna make our living with.
They have an advantage over Germany in that you're right. The climate in Germany, there are years when it doesn't get to the specified temperature to make ice wine. So there are years when they just simply can't produce it. So they are more scarce. And in Germany, it is a riskier venture. And so that's why German ice wines often are more expensive, because they've got to recoup those costs, you know, in some way.
Well, yeah, because they can lose an entire season, right? I mean, if it doesn't get down to the right temperature, you have to make a decision ahead of time. Do I let these grapes, do I pick them now, or do I let them go through the winter and see if we can do it? If you let it go, there's no turning back, right? You can't change your mind.
It's not that you change your mind. It's a matter of how your wine is labeled. They do make wine from those grapes. It's not like they just, you know, walk away from it. But the grapes are then labeled essentially late harvest.
Okay.
And so the price that can be commanded for that is substantially different than what you can get for an authentic ice wine.
Right.
And yes, Canada, there has not been a year since, you know, whenever they started, there's not been a year when the temperatures did not reach the required minimum, which is -8 degrees Celsius, or that translates into 17.6 degrees Fahrenheit. It's always gotten that low. Now, when it's achieved those temperatures has fluctuated greatly. So the yields, as I was explaining earlier, the amount of ice wine that could be made in any particular year has fluctuated greatly.
When you say 17 degrees Fahrenheit, that's cold. Like, I don't like to go outside when it's 30. So,
now, well, then you better move from New Hampshire.
I know. So I just run to my car. So what does it take for these harvesters? Do they literally go out there in this weather all bundled up? I mean, can you wear gloves and everything when you're picking grapes off the vine that you got to be so careful with?
You better wear gloves as you're picking these grapes off the vine. And I do have to point out before I go on, -8 degrees Celsius is the minimum temperature at which ice wine grapes can be picked. The preferred temperature to pick ice wine grapes is 14 degrees to 10 degrees. So there, and even as low as 6 degrees, although that's extraordinary for a number of reasons that I might or might not get into.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is pretty cold. And you bet, they are all bundled up. And I would suspect that there is a great deal of brandy and coffee that's being consumed when these grapes are being picked. Because not only are you working in those temperatures, but those temperatures usually aren't achieved until the middle of the night. So typically an ice wine harvest will start around midnight to 2 a.m., more often than not. And a lot of this has to do with complying with the law. It's all about temperature. One of the myriad of requirements that Canada and Germany and Austria has, the grapes may not be artificially frozen below the minimum ever. When you start the process of picking them, from picking to pressing, you know, this whole process of getting your ice wine juice to ferment, that's a process that takes about 6 hours from start to finish.
Okay.
At no time can that temperature go above the minimum. So that's why they're doing it in the middle of the night, to have that window of opportunity. Because if the temperature goes above 17 degrees, forget it. You cannot label that juice as ice wine.
So you're pretty much, it's a race against time, but the only consistent value you got is until the sun comes up, the chances are pretty good that the temperature's not going to rise out of the middle of nowhere. So you're starting this off. Now, when you say they're pressing it, does that mean let's say they pick these 2 a.m., they finished picking the grapes, they've got to press them right then. Do they do it outside, or do they have a place that's because you said it can't be artificially chilled, but can they have a pressing facility that's just really cold? Or
they go about it in two different ways, depending on the location of the vineyard and the distance from the vineyard, you know, to a facility. They either have facilities, you know, crushing facilities that are close by, and it's a continuous process. The grapes are picked, they're thrown into a hopper. The hopper gets full, it goes to the press. As they pick more grapes, they go to the hopper. So it's You know, it's like, you know. It's not like, yeah, we're going to pick all these grapes. Then the trucks leave the vineyard. It's truly a continuous process. If the vineyard is remote, they have basket presses that they haul out into the vineyard. And so they're, you know, so that, you know, the distance is 100, 200, 500 feet from the vineyard to the press.
Right. So that's some crazy stuff.
You bet.
I wouldn't want to be doing that job. That's not me.
It's very interesting in the early days of the ice wine industry. And when people were experimenting back in the 80s, this was such a novelty. It was fun. There are all kinds of anecdotes. You know, one winemaker, they would have Christmas dinner, and then they'd all go out and pick ice wine grapes. Well, it's like, you know, winery tourism is a big, it's in fashion now. People think it's fun to go and participate in a harvest. And if, you know, and it is, if you've never done it before.
Right, right.
If you've ever done it, I guarantee you, you're only going to do it once. And when you're done with it, pretty much everybody agrees, well, I'm glad I did it, but I am never going to do that again. And it's the same thing with an ice wine harvest. It's like, you know, not only do you have just the sheer physical effort that's required in picking these grapes, you're doing it in, you're freezing.
Right. There's a mental game in there.
Right. And so, yeah, this is a real effort.
You had said that the optimal temperature being like 10 to 14 Fahrenheit. That's going to make, and we had talked earlier when we were communicating about the difference in the sweetness levels, where the longer you wait, well, to a degree, the better, the more sweet, I guess the higher the quality, really, you're going to be getting. So you want the highest quality possible. I would guess every vineyard wants to be able to say, this is the best on the market today. They want to wait until it gets cold, but there's, again, a risk with that, right?
In regard to the colder the temperature, the higher the sugar content of the grape. This is true. At 17 degrees, your Brix level is going to be around 35 degrees Brix. At 14 degrees, you're around 14 degrees Fahrenheit, you're around 39 to 40 degrees Brix. At 10 degrees, you're up around 45-ish. At 14 degrees, you're up around 50, 55 degrees Brix. So that is correct in terms of the colder it gets, the higher the sugar.
Right.
Now, you don't necessarily, ice winemakers don't necessarily want a grape that's 55 degrees Brix, because as one winemaker was recalling, because he pressed at that temperature, and it was at 55 degrees Brix, and he said, this isn't juice, this isn't nectar, this is honey. I mean, it is just off the charts sweet. At 55 degrees Brix, that is really, really difficult to ferment because of all that sugar. And there is a standard in ice winemaking that winemakers are shooting for. And that is, ice winemakers are shooting for. And it is the balance between sugar and acid, because it is that balance that makes an ice wine great or it makes it not great. I think you might agree, referring to your Boston experience, where when you said you had some ice wines that you thought weren't so good.
Right.
And I might venture a guess that the reason you thought they weren't so good is that they were probably really, really sweet, but there wasn't that refreshing acidity that came behind it. So you were left with something that was a little bit more cloying than what you were expecting.
Right. And it's hard as a drinker, that if you're not into this that much. Like at the time, I was just, you know, I'm in there just trying out what to try out and doing a little bit of tasting on like trying to scientifically figure it out. But there's so many people there. It's the lines are so big. You've got like 5 seconds to take a sip and decide. So at the time, it's hard to translate what didn't I like, but I know there's something. And it's probably the acidity, because like the wines that I've had, the Enniskillen wines, they have a good, strong acidity to them that you get at the end. It's like it's a sour apple bite is the way I was kind of explaining it, like a Granny Smith, just that little bite. It wasn't enough to make you, you know, overly acidic wine. It's the correct balance between nice sweet attack, good mid-palate transition with maybe some apples and some pears and some apricots. Then you get that back-end acidity. Otherwise, you've got this unbalanced seesaw of flavors that you're like, it was kind of good, but then I lost it.
Well, bingo. And so in relation to your question about the temperature at which you harvest, it's all about the Brix level and the style of ice wine you're going for. I don't want to speak for any of the winemakers, because therein is how they make ice wines their own. And so some wine, Bruce Nicholson at Enniskillen, the ice winemaker at Enniskillen, I believe, as I recall, he feels that 39.5 degrees to 40 degrees Brix is the sweet spot. And your finished ice wine is going to just be perfectly balanced and have those qualities that you described. Other ice wine makers might and do feel differently, where 42 degrees Brix is something that they're shooting for. The window, from what I can determine, and if there are ice wine makers listening, I can stand corrected, but as I understand it, they are shooting for somewhere between 39 and 45 maximum degrees Brix. Any higher, any lower, the wines get out of balance, and then people can tell the difference.
Right, and they might not know why, but there's a reason.
Right, there's a reason. And so that's why they're, you know, watching these temperatures and the degrees Brix like a hawk, so that they can come up with the perfect balance. And that's what's changing from year to year. Those are where, you know, your temperature changes are affecting it. The difference is, and I guess maybe what I said earlier was unfair, where there's not huge quality differences from year to year like there is a Chardonnay. I would imagine someone who is very expert in ice wine would say, well, of course there are, and that was a naive statement on my part.
Well, yeah, but you've got, when you're talking about an industry where we haven't even got to where people have heard in some cases of ice wine, that they might, you know, there's not a lot of people, I would gather, that aren't sitting down at a table. Like, I don't know anybody who's sitting at a table and go, yeah, I don't like the Brix level of this ice wine, or I don't like this off balance, where with a red wine or a white wine, because it's more generally known and there's more people that are drinking it now, that you could sit around a table and have an intelligent conversation about a specific red and say, this is why I think it's off balance. People haven't got there yet with ice wine, where most people, I think, go, whoa, this is sweet, and they're totally into the experience. They haven't yet had enough brands or enough variation and stuff to get that level.
Well, most people just don't have the personal experience, you know, on which to draw, because these wines are rare. They're expensive. Availability, while they are a lot more available than they, you know, were in 1999, they are still generally considered to be rare wines, not only in the volume that is produced, but in where people can find them. And so there just, not yet, has been the opportunity for a lot of people to taste a variety of these from different producers, to have the personal knowledge to say, oh yeah, okay, this isn't as good and you know, right, for the reasons that you have expressed.
Especially with the economy as it happens to be right now.
Yes. Ice wine can be very costly. The Inniskillen wines for a half bottle run $65 to $90. That's generally what you're going to find them right in the marketplace. Jackson Triggs has done something that I think is brilliant. And they are making their Vidal ice wine available in the United States in a quarter bottle. It's a 187 milliliter bottle. It retails at $20. So this is an affordable introduction to ice wine, because people are, you know, if they don't know something and they're not sure they're going, you know, they're going to like it, they're certainly not going to drop $65 on a half a bottle of wine.
Right.
However, $20 is generally affordable, and it's like, great, I'll find out if I like it, and you know, and if I do, and I generally tend to think people do, and then they get hooked, and like everything else, you know, when you first tasted a Bordeaux and you know, maybe were in college or whatever, you didn't have much money, and you fell in love, all of a sudden you were jonesing for a good Bordeaux, right, and blowing your budget.
Yeah, so you could justify the cost. If you, it's all cost justification. If you know that you know what, I really want that $60 bottle, and I do the same thing, because when I first had ice wine, I don't even know how I found it, but when I found it tucked away in the little corner, because we have a control station, so we have, you know, we have our little liquor stores, but wine, you'll never find, I don't think, ice wine in a grocery store. But if you go to the liquor store, it's usually near the dessert wines, the champagnes, and it's kind of tucked over there. And so I bought the cheapest bottle I could, which I believe was about $25 US, and you know, that was expensive, but I had a reason. I didn't go in there just because I wanted to buy $25 worth of wine. I was doing this show. I was doing things. I wanted to review things. I want to experiment. I'm the everyday drinker. I need to try everything. So for me, there was a reason to spend $25. Once I did that, then it was like $50 isn't so bad. You know, it's half, but it's got to be better. And you get into this weird justification of the expense. But I like. Yeah, but I like the idea, because we went through the Vidal. I mean, the other problem with the ice wine is when we open a bottle, it doesn't last very long. Not necessarily the size, because you can't put it down. The Vidal, the Jackson Triggs bottle size got us about, I think, me and my wife together, four glasses, you know, half filled.
That's about right.
And then I also did some cocktails, and there, you know, because the cocktails are like a half ounce here or an ounce here, it's not consuming a lot. That night I experimented with a little bit. So I got some extra out of it. But the thing is, with ice wine, it's so sweet and delicious, but it's also something you don't just sit down and drink a bottle of. It's you can only take so many desserts, right? Nobody just sits there and eats cookies all night. You eventually,
well,
your body,
people.
Yeah, some people. this is true. There are those, but it's enough for you to be able to buy maybe two bottles for like an event. If you have like you're entertaining company, and you're going to be the host of the night, because you're going to be like, oh, you got to try this. Oh, what's that? And you bring it out. It didn't cost you a fortune. And if they don't like it, it's not. I don't know if that can happen, but it's not going to be a huge loss. You can still drink it yourself. So you get enough for enough servings to spread it around, and you drink a half a glass, because a whole glass could be a little too much. And it's a good, I like the value versus the size. You don't feel like you're getting ripped off just because it's a lot of money for a quarter of a bottle or whatnot. It's a lot of money, but it's a lot of taste and quality value. So you're not getting, it's not like I'm getting ripped off. It's like, I want a nip, you know. That's why they make alcohol nips, so people can experiment and see what they like.
Sure.
And this is a close, but a nip of ice wine would be just not enough.
Well, Derek, I have to tell you, I mean, this is the best endorsement. I mean, this is sort of what you've just said are what my clients expect me to say, and so I'm glad you said it.
Well, what I end up doing is I go, it's like Sam's Club, and they had a cases of ice wine. It was $15. I can't even remember the brand. I have a couple downstairs. I bought them because they were $15. I thought it was a deal. I'm sure plenty of people walking right by, but if you put like a Jackson Triggs you know, the what was the size, 187 or so?
Yeah, quarter bottle.
You put a quarter bottle at on a cornerstone at the liquor store or at the wine store, and people are going to innately pick it up and go, ah, $20. So, you know, it's an experiment. And that's going to be what they need. Otherwise, how are we going to know? We can't expect to go in and buy $60 a bottle of something we have yet to have heard of.
Right. Right, exactly. And that's why I said I thought that Jackson Triggs was brilliant in making these quarter bottles available in the United States.
Okay, so what I wanted to ask is, well, actually, first off, you have mentioned the Brix thing, and I don't know how many people are lost at the terminology. Is Brix easy to explain what a Brix level is or percentage or...
Sure. It's fairly easy to explain. Brix is a scale much the same as a thermometer. It's called degrees Brix. It is a methodology of measuring the amount of sugar that is in a grape, because as we all know, it is the sugars that are being fermented. So when winemakers are making wine, they need to know what the Brix level of, you know, of the juice that they're working with, because that's going to dictate the amount and possibly the kind of yeast that they use to get the wine to ferment. Table wines generally are harvested at 20 to 25 degrees Brix. Ice wines, the minimum, as we've discussed, is 35 degrees Brix. That's about as simplified as I can make that.
So you get your comparison between, because I noticed that Brix is really called out on sweeter drinks that I don't see, like, nobody seems to care when you're looking at a standard bottle of wine what its Brix level is.
No, Brix, usually you're not going to see Brix mentioned on a wine label. Typically what you see is residual sugar.
Right.
And that is going to let you know pretty much what to expect in that wine, whether it's going to be sweet or going to be dry. And of course, that has a lot to do with the winemaking style and when fermentation stops. In dessert wines and late harvest wines, they want to call that out because that's a hallmark of these wines, you know, where the sugar level was at. You know, it's a point of quality, a point of pride. And so, yes, that's why you usually only see the term on late harvest and ice wine.
Okay, so it's really slightly, not marketing, but kind of give you an indicator of where you're going with it. Like, this is what you know what you're going to expect.
Yes.
A little bit. You kind of know what you're going to expect in sweetness or on your palate. You don't know what the wine is going to specifically taste like, but it gives you a
Well, glass. Sure. And in terms of what we, you know, were talking about earlier, even though I, you know, when I'm trying a new ice wine, I look at the label to see who made it. I don't want the rest of the information. I don't want to have any preconceptions about what it is I'm about to taste. I'm a live for a moment guy, you know. However, you know, for the sake of argument, if I were to look at labels and if I were, you know, just judging a book by its cover, as it were, I would have an idea of what to expect if I saw a wine that said, you know, the grapes were harvested at 35 degrees Brix. And if another one said the grapes were harvested at 55 degrees Brix, I've never had one that I don't even know if anyone makes one at 55 degrees Brix. I can guarantee you if I saw that, if I could afford it, I'd buy it because I want to taste it. It's like, how in the hell did you even get this stuff to ferment?
Right. And then if you have a high, let's say 55 degrees, is that going to bring down the alcohols in there? Are you going to end up with like an 8%, or does that not necessarily matter? Because it's harder to ferment it, right? When it's, and it takes longer if it's than a table wine.
It does take substantially longer than a table wine because there are more sugars that have to be converted into alcohol. And it's, you know, where that fermentation stops. And this is starting to get into science where I've got a – this vague understanding of the science, but for a real authoritative explanation of this, I would have to defer, you know, to an ice wine maker. But as I understand it, the type of yeast that they are using to make ice wine is working on one or two of the types of sugars that are found in grapes. You've got three types of sugars: sucrose, glucose, fructose. And specific yeasts ferment the specific sugars in that wine. And so if you've got a wine at a juice, and really we've kind of wandered off the path here because I really don't think anyone is trying to ferment anything at 55 degrees Brix. But I would assume what they would do is identify what percentage of, you know, fructose, sucrose, glucose is making up, you know, that sweetness, and using an appropriate yeast to ferment the sugars that they would want to ferment.
Now, can you make one that's really high in alcohol, or is that just dumb? Like, I mean, it can be done, right? I just know they're all pretty light.
Well, sure, you can. I mean, you can pretty much turn anything in, you know,
grain into alcohol.
into grain alcohol. Legally, ice wine has to be a minimum of 7.5% alcohol and a maximum of 14.9% alcohol. That is what the legal specifications are for that. Do winemakers want a highly alcoholic ice wine? I don't think that's a hallmark of ice wine. You want fresh fruit flavors. You want crisp acidity. I don't think anyone would want to go for that ethanol that you would get, and like you're getting in, you know, Zinfandels and those really ripe red wines these days. That's not a hallmark of, you know, what is ice wine.
Right.
And so legally, they're mandated not to go above 14%. And I think that anyone that would even approach 14%, that would be an ice wine that was not really well received.
Right.
And then they generally tend to be somewhere between 9.5% and 11%.
Yeah. Normally, that's about what I see. Normally, close probably to 9 or 10. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's just all part of it. They're just not a highly alcoholic wine. That's not what they're going for when they're making stuff.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea because there's plenty of other things we could get wasted on.
Absolutely.
Now, what is it with the Niagara Peninsula and the VQA? This is sort of like, is the Niagara Peninsula where the majority or the only place that ice wine is kind of where they cultivate the cool grapes there? Is that the place to be?
Well, a producer in Niagara would probably say the answer to that question is yes.
Obviously. And,
yes. The Niagara ice wine is made all over Canada commercially.
Okay.
There are two major wine regions in Canada. There is the Niagara Peninsula in Ontario and the Okanagan Valley that is in British Columbia. And basically, a lot of people haven't heard of the Okanagan Valley. If you think Washington State wine and the Washington State wine country, just keep driving north because it begins right there at the border between Washington and British Columbia. And while the Okanagan Valley is about 100 miles in length, maybe 120 miles in length, it is that lower 60 miles where their wine industry is concentrated.
Right.
Pretty much anything north of there, and it's getting a little too cold to make decent wines. Both British Columbia and the Niagara Peninsula produce ice wines. The Niagara Peninsula has an advantage over British Columbia, wherein temperatures are guaranteed that they're going to hit,
Oh, okay.
And hit probably earlier. And this is just because of location, location, location. British Columbia is a little bit dicier about when that minimum temperature is going to be reached. So it's a little bit riskier to produce it in British Columbia. They're doing it, and there are several producers up there that are doing it well, but it is a riskier venture. The VQA, and I'm glad you brought this up, because most Americans don't know what this is about, and I find this to be a particularly interesting organization in Canada. It stands for Vintners Quality Alliance, and basically, this is Canada's system of appellation, much the same as our AVA. It defines a wine region, you know, the boundaries, and all of that stuff. The VQA goes a lot farther, however, than the American Viticultural Association does, and particularly when it comes to the production of ice wine. And this is where the VQA is the legal authority.
Right.
And it became official. I think it was called the VQA Act of 1999, and it was signed into law in the year 2000. And so that's when the standardization came into law. And when it comes to ice wine, the Canadians are very, very serious about producing the authentic thing and making sure that the industry is 100% credible. The Vintners Quality Alliance will, you know, say the minimum degrees at which ice wine grapes can be harvested, and that's 17.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Can't be any warmer. The harvest cannot begin before November 15th. The alcohol that's in the wine has to be derived from the sugars naturally found in the grapes, which means you can't – yeah, no adding sugar. The finished must, you know, when you press this, it's got to be 35 degrees Brix. This goes on and on and on. It's not that, you know, these rules are in place. Some of the vendors refer to the VQA as the ice wine police, because you have to, when you're going to harvest, you have to call them and say, okay, we're going to harvest this vineyard tonight. Everything looks right. They'll send a representative out there with a thermometer who will make sure that the temperature is the temperature, and you know, that needs to be required, and it's certified, and there's all this reporting that they have to do. You know, you also have to report the temperature at harvest, how much acreage you harvested, how much you got off of that acre, because they want to make sure that you're not like padding with other grapes that you've been saving,
right,
you know,
right.
Oh boy, howdy. The British Columbia, the VQA operates, the standards are a little bit different between British Columbia and Ontario. There's one standard in British Columbia that I think is really kind of funny, and there's a specific reason why it's there. The grapes must be transferred from the field to the press by the most direct route. Wait a minute. This is in the rules. And you'd think, well, yeah, okay, you know, sure, why not? The reason that this is in there, what back in the 80s, as people were experimenting with this, some winemaker in the Okanagan Valley, it wasn't quite cold enough. Now, mind you, the laws weren't in place yet. He wasn't breaking any laws, but it wasn't 17 degrees when he harvested. And so he harvested the grapes, loaded them onto a truck, and drove the truck up into the mountains, because the Okanagan Valley is bordered by two very large mountain ranges. And so the higher up you go, the colder it gets.
Right.
So he drove the grapes up the mountain where it got colder, and then he drove the grapes down the mountain to the pressing facility. And the industry was aware that this was an experiment that had been done, and they wanted to be sure that no one ever thought that they might get away with this. And so it's part of their law.
It's almost like the artificial freezing, but it's – It's natural freezing using artificial means.
Sort of, yeah. And that's rule number one that I don't think that I even approached. No artificial freezing can be part of this process at any time.
So now, can you do that? I mean, who's to say you can, right? Do they have a name for it when if you use a mechanical means to freeze the grapes? Or
Cryo extraction.
And that's cool. It's just got different labels, no?
To be labeled ice wine, you got to follow all the rules. If you don't follow the rules, you don't get to label it ice wine. So you're not in the United States or in Canada, you're not going to see anything labeled ice wine that doesn't have VQA on it. It can't happen. If it's not made according to the standards, then it can't be certified VQA. No one in Canada, well, now I don't know that for certain. I don't think that anyone in Canada is making a wine using an artificial method of freezing. However, it is being done in the United States. And there's one company that is very proud of making this in the United States. When they applied for label approval, they wanted to call it ice wine, but the TTB said, no, you can't call it ice wine. And so they call it vin de glacier, wine of the freezer. So yes, it can be done. It is being done. There are other companies that are making wines that are artificially frozen. They're priced usually accordingly. It's not like they're trying to mislead the consumer in essentially making a fake ice wine, but charging ice wine prices for it.
Right.
This vin de glacier, I think, retails at $19 a half a bottle. And for what it is, and again, I like sweet wines. There is not a dessert wine that I've met that I didn't like. And so for what it is, it's a lovely little dessert wine. Is it ice wine? No.
No, but it's something different. I mean, it could be, as long as people are able to come up with something creative, and it's got to be tasty. My main concern, of course, would be that you're not pricing it for the effort that these guys are going through, the low yields they're going to get, because you could predict what you're going to be able to do if you're making it all mechanical. You know your yields.
Sure. And in the United States, I don't think that anyone is making deliberate fakes. Although there are some wines out there that I have seen on the shelves that I have purchased that are labeled ice wines that they're not. I mean, they're just not. Just by the taste. I mean, I can tell immediately this isn't an ice wine. Now, it didn't have a premium price tag, and I don't want to name names on this. but it is something that, you know, the ice wine industry is very concerned about. It has happened here in the United States on occasion, and it's misleading to the consumer because it says ice wine on the label. They taste it. The one in particular that I had, not only was it not ice wine, it just wasn't very good wine. And I thought, wow, you know, I would hate for someone to taste this and think that they've tasted ice wine.
Oh, yeah, then they won't buy anymore.
Sure. Now, since I'm talking about fakes, this is a huge, huge problem over in the Asian countries.
Yeah. Everything over there, you know, they've got fakes of everything.
Cigarettes, yeah, pretty much across the board.
Right.
And they are, this is a huge problem wherein they're making fakes, they're photocopying labels, they're just throwing whatever they can into these bottles and selling them at the, you know, the going price point for these ice wines, which is very, very damaging to the industry and something that the, you know, the Canadians are very active in trying to fight.
Yeah.
But as I said, it is much more of a problem over there than it's over here. Even though the United States hasn't agreed on the standards of ice wine as Germany, Austria, and Canada have, in 2000, I believe it was, they all signed an agreement that said, okay, the standards by which wines that will be labeled ice wine are made are the same in our three countries. The United States didn't sign on to that. There are some rules in the TTB, but they're not nearly as extensive as they are in Canada. But generally, the United States wine producers tend to be an honest bunch. And so we do have some ice wine production, particularly in New York State, Washington State, Michigan.
I haven't had Washington, but I've definitely had I've had a couple Washingtons actually that they sell in New Hampshire. So I'm guessing they've made their way over here, and they're pretty good. I mean, they taste like ice wine, I guess is the key. They're not necessarily like the Cabernet Franc or, you know, some of the other ones that I've had from Enniskillen, but they're, you know, they're priced accordingly, like you said. They're not $60, $70. They're like $25, $30 at most, maybe even $15 in some cases. But
well, and also part of it's because they've got larger yields. In Washington State, there's one particular producer of ice wine. I found it very, very interesting in that their harvest – pretty much guaranteed every year. It's like Mother Nature is operating on, you know, the exact same schedule every year. Their ice wine harvest happens on Halloween, either the day before Halloween or Halloween. That's when it gets to the temperature there up in the valley. And so they don't have that hang time. I mean, this is October.
Right.
The wines that are being made in Canada are hanging on that vine from September into, well, at least November 15th, and generally around December, January, February. And so Canada's getting a lot less yield because of dehydration and critters eating them and, you know, all manner of, you know, what can happen to a grape as it's sitting on a vine.
Is there like one or two grape varieties that do better in the winter months? Like you had mentioned, the Vidal is very hardy. I guess the real heart of the question is, does a grape that has less of a chance any better than one that's a hardy grape, or is it just different?
Can you make ice wine out of any grape? And the answer, of course, is yes, you probably can. If the grape will, you know, last on a vine and get frozen, you can make ice wine out of it. Can you make an ice wine that is commercially viable, that is a good ice wine? And I think that's the question that you are asking. The Vidal grapes, that is the best grape to use for ice wine. And 3/4 of ice wine that is made in Canada is made with a Vidal grape. One of the reasons is that it's a late ripening variety. In all ice wines, you want to use late ripening varieties like Vidal, Riesling, Chenin Blanc, Sauval Blanc, because, you know, coming on at the end of the season when these flavors develop is going to produce a more fruitier, flavorful, fresh and clean wine than a grape that ripens earlier in the season.
Yeah.
Back to the Vidal grape. The Vidal grape, man, this is like the best grape to use in making ice wines and for commercial production of ice wine. It's just like this bingo grape variety across the board. From a commercial aspect, the vines are very, very hardy. It's got to get really, really cold to kill the vines, whereas a Riesling, a grapevine, a Cabernet Franc, a grapevine Chardonnay, you know, there's just a certain threshold when it gets colder, you start losing vines. In regard to the grape variety itself, in addition to the just all of the flavors being in this grape,
right,
it's got a thick skin, which birds don't like. It's like if the birds have a choice between a Gewurztraminer grape or a Chardonnay grape or a Vidal grape, they're going to go after all of these other varieties before they go after Vidal, which I ask a bird why that is. Because of this thick skin, you don't get as much dehydration. You also don't get the skin's splitting. It's, you know, as water freezes, it expands.
Right.
And I'm sure that we've all put a bottle of wine in the freezer and, you know, the bottle's exploded.
Forgot about it.
Yeah. So it's the same thing that happens with a grape. You know, as the water freezes in the grape expands. Vidal grapes are thick skin and they tend not to split like other varieties will. And so for this reason, and all of these reasons, that's why the Vidal grape has proven to be really, really perfect for making ice wine. And the second most popular is Riesling for a number of reasons, one of which it being, you know, cold hardy as well, and you know, all of the flavor qualities, and it's cold tolerant, and it's you know, what Germany uses.
Right, right.
And so, you know, those cool climate loving late ripening varieties are what are, you know, not only make good ice wine, but are commercially viable. Those are the vines that you want to
use. Yeah, I'm a big, so far, my favorite has been the Riesling. Like the different flavors. Everybody's got a different palate, but for sure. I like the Riesling. I like the Gewurztraminer. I found that the Gewurztraminer that I had that you sent it wasn't as sweet from and I don't know if it's because it was older, like because it was a 2002.
Yeah, it was an old vintage, but that shouldn't that ice wines hold for a long time. It's and that's why I sent it to you. I mean, because you indicated you really love Gewurztraminer.
That thing didn't last long at all.
Yeah, I suspected not. But it's just so you could see what a different style you end up with in using a different variety.
Yeah, it was just different. So it was like, in which I like, because I like, if I'm going to experiment with something, I want it to be so I feel like I'm getting a different flavor. If I could get a Riesling, a Gewurztraminer, and a Vidal, and they all taste the same, then you know I'll get the cheapest. But you're looking for all the different complexities. Certain ones have a different thickness, certain sweets, certain organic tastes. Like I think the Gewurz had a little more organic mineral something in it that made it different, made it more unique. So you felt like you're getting something for what you've purchased. You know, it's just different. And I like uniqueness.
It's funny. I was going to talk about, I don't know if I can pronounce this word, homogeneity in the wine world, and how, you know, everyone, it's like all of a sudden all the Chardonnays, no matter where they come from, they all kind of taste the same.
Right.
I appreciate the differences in terroir. And I think ice wines really do reflect, it's not only the sense of place, but it's that climate in which they're produced. And that's why if you were to do a comparison tasting between a Canadian ice wine from Ontario and an ice wine from Washington State, that I would think, I really never tell people what they should taste, but I think that they would find that the Ontario ice wines were much more voluptuous. And this has to do with hang time, temperature, you know, at harvest, and all of these environmental factors.
Right. And you've got variety. It's you've got your vintage, you've got your grape varietal, then you've got your region where today, because, and maybe this will never be the case with ice wine, because it's the yields are low and there's a lot more that goes into making it a success from like learning, like as you said with the nets, that there's, I don't know if it'll ever grow as big as a mass market like Chardonnay might. I'm hoping that it will grow and people will learn it and enjoy it, and it'll be something that you'd be like, you could say ice wine and everybody will recognize, but I hope it never loses its identity.
Oh, it can't. It can't lose its identity for a number of reasons, one of which is not only, you know, the way by which it must be made legally. Secondly, it's always going to be rare. It's just, you know, the number of people that want to get in to making ice wine and, you know, can afford to make ice wine, it is increasing. But there, you know, if you are going to make ice wine, that is just kind of translates into, okay, then you're going to make less table wines just because of the amount of grapes that you can grow. Now, as Canada's wine industry grows, and it is growing, and they've got lots of land that they can still plant.
Right.
We will probably in the next 20 years see more ice wines. You know, the production, the country's production will increase. Usually when that happens, when there's more of something available, that affects the price at which these things are available. And so I would suppose, I don't think it's outside of the imagination to say that, you know, we will see more ice wines available in the United States at, you know, at an affordable entry price. More people can enjoy them, but it's certainly not going to become, you know, like Chardonnay.
Yeah,
it's always going to be a niche product. It's always going to be a luxury product. It's always going to be like a, you know, a good Sauternes.
Then that kind of brings me into this question about serving it with meals. Is there an ice wine varietal or maybe a specific brand, a year or something? Is there one that best fits or pairs with a meal or maybe a cheese or something like that? Or is it always usually after dinner?
Well, if it were up to me, you'd be pouring it on your Cheerios.
Right.
And I have to say, I mean, even though I am certainly joking about this.
Does it go good with Cheerios? Come on.
I think it would. Actually, I think it would go. I wouldn't want to. You pour it on a Cheerio. But I'll bet if you ate a Cheerio and took a sip of ice wine, that would be, actually be a good pairing. Because the Cheerio is just slightly sweet. And when you're pairing, if you're pairing ice wine with a dessert, you want your wine to be sweeter than the dessert,
right,
or else you're going to end up with this just – it's a disaster. It doesn't work. And so generally what most people, especially in Canada, and I don't think there's a winemaker in Canada who wouldn't say, first and foremost, enjoy white ice wine by itself as a dessert, or serve your sweets later, but just enjoy this wine by itself. And you know, there is just so much going on with this wine. It is such a roller coaster of flavors. It really is satisfying all by itself. Now, that all said, people in America pretty much have it in their heads that sweet happens at the end of a meal.
Right.
And so that's how it, you know, is generally thought of as being a dessert wine. Now, over in the Asian countries, that's sweet is definitely something that is not just at the end of the meal. Sweet is something that happens all through a meal. And I have found that ice wines pair beautifully with all kinds of food. Spicy Asian cuisine, I mean, it's like great. It's exactly what you want with those. With foie gras, if you're not opposed to foie gras, so many people are these days. I mean, that is a divine, divine pairing. And with cheeses in particular, it is so perfect with strong, salty cheeses. It's just that combination of savory, salt, and sweet. The foremost cheese person, evangelist, I call her in the United States, is Laura Werlin. She has written and sold 4 books on cheeses. And she described it most recently, I think in one of her talks, with a blue cheese. And I think she was speaking about the Jackson Triggs Vidal ice wine. She said the combinations of flavors is crazy making on the palate, crazy making in being good. And so ice wine, I really think that if people are, you know, thinking in terms of it in just being as dessert, I mean, as long as they're buying it, you know, I'm all for it. But I think people are missing out on other opportunities to enjoy these wines.
Like right now I'm seeing that I would assume what people are going to do is they're going to, you know, just try ice wine because they may never have had it and go, oh, wow, that's completely different. Now you're going to go to the next stage, and that's kind of where I get we got food pairings, we got cocktails, like where I'm going, look, you've got, I wouldn't use an entire bottle, $60 plus, to make cocktails, but while it's open, you know, maybe one night I'm going to cook up one of these cocktails because it's different. Maybe I'm going to sit down with some cheese. And because I found that usually during, I don't know why, maybe it's my mood, but usually during around the winter time is usually when I really sit down with, I go out, buy some cheese and sit down with some crackers and some wine and kind of experiment. And that's not the only thing I do with that open bottle of wine, but it gives me more value to what I've got. I can do something different with it. And it's a little bit of enjoyment. Maybe it's a little nerdy. I don't know.
Well, it's a bit of enjoyment. And, you know, it's okay to be a geek.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with it.
But in one of the reviews I did, I think it was the Enniskillen. No, did I do the Vidal? No, I haven't done Vidal. It might have been the Jackson Traces, that I found that the acidity actually makes me salivate. So I was suggesting that this is probably something you want to have before a meal, because it gets you ready. It gets your palate ready for a steak or whatnot. As you're sitting there, take a half a cup or whatever, and then it's almost like it begins the meal. It doesn't necessarily have to just end it.
Well, and if that works for you, that's great. As I said, I think earlier, and I think you found when I, sent you these wines, I don't want to put any thoughts into people's heads. I don't want to say, okay, you're going to taste this. You're going, to detect this. That it's like, because everybody detects flavor differently. I mean, we all perceive flavors differently. I mean, I might be eating something and I think, wow, this has, this might be a little salty here. And the person sitting next to me eating the exact same thing is like shaking the salt on it. And so we all perceive this differently. And I am not going to say this is how it should taste and when you should drink it. And truly, if you want to pour it on Cheerios, pour it on Cheerios. Knock yourself out if that's what makes you happy. And not just with ice wines, but in anything in your life, don't let anybody tell you how you should be enjoying something. Enjoy it in the way that it gives you maximum pleasure.
Then the last question is, and this is completely off topic purposely, if you're not drinking ice wine, what table wine would you prefer?
What wine am I drinking? Usually in the summertime, I'm drinking whites, and in the wintertime, I'm drinking reds. Most often, I'm drinking whiskey. when I drink wine, that's generally, I'm kind of a seasonal guy with those table wines.
So do you like that? Like, I'm a big fan of the Gewürztraminer. I like a Riesling, and then a Malbec is usually my red preference. I don't really know why, but I tend to go that way. But I could drink everything, but for some reason, those ones are usually where I end up gravitating towards.
The ones that I end up gravitating toward, and I know I'm in the minority on this, I gravitate towards like the really unusual wines. I like regional wines. I like things from California. I like things from Washington State. I like wines from France. But I like also tasting wines from places that, really aren't known for their wines.
Like Africa.
Well, I do like South African wines.
Oh, they're so good.
I think so. I have a South African wine client, so I mean, not only am I agree because I do believe in these wines. No, I'm talking about Illinois and Wisconsin and Michigan, where are these wines going to score well? No, but there's just a bit. It's, wine has been a part of culture for time immemorial. Everybody that can make it. And it is always a labor of love. These smaller producers, they're making the best wines that they can possibly make given the area where they're making these wines. Right. And so I appreciate trying those. By and large, unless the wine just isn't made very well, like a winemaker doesn't know what he's doing, I appreciate those wines.
All right, well, I don't want to take any more of your time right now. We're about an hour 38 in, and I figure you got a job to do. You got to push more ice wine.
Hell no. It's Derek, it's 4:53 in the afternoon. It's time for me to go have a drink. my day is done.
Yeah, I guess that's the advantage. I'm on the East Coast. I lose a little bit. But I'm going to go eat dinner, so that's close.
Okay, cool.
All right, well, I appreciate the time. Hopefully everybody can get a good – I mean, we've done the ice wine show, so for those that want to know what we thought of our initial impressions, especially since most of the people on the show had never even had an ice wine, you can get that perspective. Then combined with this perspective, and I think we've covered the reactionary, what it tastes like, and the history, what goes into it. And I think between the two episodes, we got it all. Now cool. We just have to spread the word. All right, well, I thank you for giving us a great enlightenment into the world of ice wine.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Derek. And hopefully we'll have occasion to do something together again. Maybe next time you look at South African wines.
That sounds great.
Cool, we'll do it.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, take care.
All right, talk to you later.